Hello, and welcome back to the Spooky Scary Podcast.
Spooky Sperry.
My name is Kath.
And I'm Chris.
I just had a stroke trying to say the words spooky and scary in succession.
It has been a hot minute since we've recorded, so we're going to sound 10,000
years.
It really has. Yeah.
We're really just sitting here being like, how do we record this? What's going on?
Yeah, we've both been so busy this last month.
So we decided to take
a season break.
Like most of January and February off, we were like, listen, we're both burned out. We just need a minute. So we took a minute, but now we're back.
And we're hopefully better than ever. Well, probably not, but that's for you to decide, I guess.
On the plus side, though, we do have, I feel like this is a staple of true crime, spooky nonsense kind
That's
of thing,
true.
You know?
Yeah.
Especially, I don't know who you're talking about, but who I'm talking about is, like, one of the, like, the big boys.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm not technically doing a serial killer.
Okay.
I just really like the
story
that I'm doing.
How are you not technically a serial killer?
Because they didn't kill anyone.
Well, yes, I guess that would make you not technically a serial killer.
But it's true crime, and it's still a really good story, so I think I low-key misunderstood the theme whenever we first agreed to do it. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, I'ma still fucking do with this. And so I did.
How do you misunderstand serial killer?
Because at first, I don't think I thought we said serial killers. I thought we said, like, just true crime or something like that. And so that's my brain went with. Yeah, and then whenever we talked about it again, you said serial killers. And I was like, haha, yeah.
Totally, serial killer.
And for some reason, I just didn't say anything and didn't look up another story because I liked this one.
So you're like, now we're doing this. Well, now yeah. I'm curious.
It's a good one.
Okay, but should I go first? Are we building up the momentum for yours?
Yeah. But before we do, we have something exciting. We're not going to be halfway across the state from the country from each other anymore. For like
oh my gosh, you're totally right. In 2 weeks? Is it 2 weeks?
Yeah, it's 2 weeks from now.
So that means in listener time, like 3 weeks?
No, a week. Because we're posting this on Monday.
You're right. We are posting this on Monday.
It'll be like a week and a half.
I don't know how math works, but
that sounds
that
right,
means
at least.
That at some point in the near future you will be getting a episode where we're actually in the same room while we record it.
And I don't know about y'all, but that's impressive to me because, yeah, I don't know where I was going with that, actually.
Well, I'm kind of nervous about it because our first, I think, 3 or 4 episodes, we recorded them in the same room. And, like, they're not great.
They really aren't. But I feel like at the same time, we've also, like, put more effort into, like, stuff since then.
Oh, and, yeah, like, and we have two microphones now.
Yeah, and we, like, fully recorded sitting on my bed.
Oh, yeah, we were fully just, like, vibing out.
Yeah. So, like, I think we'll do better this time.
I believe
Hopefully.
In us.
Oof.
But I just want to say thank you to... We, like, disappeared for a month and a half, and we still somehow, in that time, hit our first 1,000 plays.
Which is absolutely wild because I think
that's dope.
Right before we went on like break, we were at like 600.
Yeah, so we like y'all keep listening, and I'm like, I appreciate you.
So, but the wait is over. New content will be coming out
starting now,
right?
So, well, shall we stop
blubbering
stalling?
And start true criming?
Yeah, especially because I have a very long story. I'm trying to, part of me is like, should I just start telling the story and see if you'll like guess who it is?
Because, well, you can do that. However, you already told me who you were doing.
Did I?
Yes.
Do you know who it is?
Yes.
Say it.
The Zodiac Killer.
Okay, you're right.
You said it like 15 minutes ago, like when we were getting ready to record. You were like, well, my Zodiac Killer story is really long. Yeah. And at first, because I thought you were like trying to purposely not talk about who it was because you were like being really like general about it. Like, oh yeah, the serial killer story I'm doing. And I was like, why don't you just tell me who you're doing? So I figured you were trying to be.
Not tell each other who we do.
That's fair. But I figured you were trying to be secretive about it. But then you were like, yeah, the serial killer, the Zodiac Killer story I'm doing is really long. And I was like, okay, cool. That's what you're doing.
I think it's because I have my notes open. And at the top, I literally just wrote Zodiac Killer. So I'm just staring at the word Zodiac Killer. So I just said them.
That's fair.
Anyway, basically, sometimes Alex, my boyfriend for new listeners, are like, if he just wants something on in the background, you know how normally people will put on like The Office or Parks and Rec or something like that? He puts on the movie Zodiac.
Oh.
I don't know what it is about that movie, like the one with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, I don't think I've actually ever seen it.
It's actually a very good movie. I read like from a lot of sources. Some people, basically, so the movie Zodiac is based on a book called Zodiac, which I'm going to talk a little bit about the guy who wrote that book, but it's this dude named Robert Graysmith, who was like a cartoonist for the newspaper at the time that the Zodiac Killers were happening. And he had like a close relationship with like one of the lead detectives who was researching it and the writer Paul Avery, who the Zodiac wrote a lot of letters to and stuff like that. And he became like very obsessed with researching the Zodiac Killer and like trying to find out who it was. Like, he was so obsessed, like it literally broke apart his marriage because his like wife left him because he spent all of his time trying to figure out who the Zodiac was.
Jesus Christ.
And so the movie is like his version of events, and it like follows him as the main character, sort of, played by Jake Gyllenhaal. And then it does kind of point to who he has, like, a very definitive, he's like, this man, like, he has a suspect who he's like, I believe wholeheartedly that this man is the Zodiac Killer. And honestly, he has me kind of convinced, but I know that there's a lot of people who are very like, no, he's an idiot, he's wrong. So, I guess take it with a grain of salt, but it's a good movie.
All right, well, I'm excited. Let's...
So that is my official film review of Zodiac, and now we'll move on to Chris's story.
All right, well, so I'm doing... No.
Okay.
Imagine if I just like started telling my story, be like, all right, cool. Yeah.
You fully just didn't realize I was joking, and you were like, oh, okay, yeah, it's my turn now.
Yeah, I was like, that was... She told me it was a long story, but damn, that was...
We just ended the episode.
Oh,
like
right, my turn.
I didn't even tell you who his suspect was.
Nope.
Okay, so the Zodiac story actually begins on December 20th of 1968. Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday were going out on their first date, and Betty Lou had promised her parents that she would be home by 11 p.m. Soon after 11 p.m., though, passing drivers saw that their car was parked at like a Lover's Lane spot along Lake Herman Road in Benicia, California. I love how, like, in the 60s, Lover's Lanes were a thing. Like, now it's just, like, a Walmart parking lot.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mine was always... Okay, so there's this, my new place that I love. There's this fucking, like, lake that exists near my house. Well, actually, no, not even near my house anymore. It's, like, 20 minutes away from where I live. But I used to live right next to it. And I can only find it on accident.
Like, you don't know where it is, you just stumble upon it?
Yep.
That's kind of fun. It's sort of like the Room of Requirement.
Yeah, that's literally, like, what I was saying, because I went with Stevie, and we were driving, and I was like, genuinely, I don't know which way to go. I just have to turn randomly and hope I find it. And then I didn't find it the first, like, time, and so I went back, and I was like, all right, we're going to try again. And then I found it.
I love that. I feel like you can't look for it now, though. You have to only find it by accident.
Yeah, that's exactly. You just have to drive aimlessly and hope you end at it.
That's fun.
So that's my story about a disappearing lake.
I'll now tell you my story about a disappearing man.
No! I'm shit, sorry, that was bad. No, that was actually really good. That was a great segue.
I was looking for a segue back in, and I was like, how do I get from this into a double homicide? So anyway, a driver that was passing the car stopped and saw that there were two bodies on the side of the road.
Oh, beautiful.
And then Benicia police... Yeah, that's... Well, no. I'd prefer if they didn't.
Sometimes you just gotta have a dead body on the street. As a treat.
I suppose that's... we can have a little dead body as a treat.
We come back and we're telling jokes even worse than we did before.
I hate us. We're bad people.
We really are. Why do you listen to us? I said that and looked at my microphone like it was supposed to answer me.
My microphone specifically is a bad person for listening to.
Honestly,
us.
Yeah.
Disrespect the dead. So anyway, Benicia police and others responded to the scene and they found Betty Lou dead with 5 bullet wounds in her back.
That's
and
too David, many.
Yeah. One is too many.
Yeah, but if you're gonna shoot someone, like, why 5 times? That's just a lot. One will get the job done.
Apparently they didn't. Not if you don't have a lot of faith in your aim.
I guess, yeah, that's fair. I wouldn't have a lot of faith in my aim.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah, probably.
David, however, was found next to the car. He had a bullet wound in his head, but he was still alive. And there were bullet holes in the car's roof and back window, which indicated that the killer may have fired into the car to force Betty Lou and David out of it. And then once they came out of the car, he shot them more.
Oh my god, that's not nice.
No, he's not, like, a nice dude.
Yeah, that's fair.
Oh, the Zodiac Killer's such a meanie.
Yeah, like, why does he have to be so mean?
Why you gotta be so rude?
Honestly, yeah.
So, shell casings were recovered at the crime scene that identified the ammunition as a Winchester Western Super X copper coated. I copy and pasted all of that. I have no idea what it means. I don't know guns. But the ballistic evidence also indicated that the killer used a .22 caliber, which appears to be a favorite of serial killers. Because I think, isn't there the .22 caliber killer who...
Yeah, I think so.
Wasn't that like Son of Sam, or was that .44 caliber?
I don't know. I think it was... I don't remember. Go back and listen to our old episodes. We talked about
and
it.
And then you can find out. And people believed that the two of them were just like random targets who were killed by a stranger. So then about 6 months later, actually on the 4th of July of 1969, Darlene Farron, who was a 22-year-old mother and waitress, went out with her friend Michael Magoo. I think it's Magoo. It might be Mejo. I don't know. I feel bad. I felt weird saying Magoo, though.
I like Magoo.
Did you ever see Mr. Magoo as a kid?
It sounds familiar, but I cannot tell you a single thing about it.
I couldn't either. It's just in my brain, like in the weird like part of my subconscious that holds random things.
That's fair.
Anyway, so whatever his last name is, Michael and Darlene were sitting in the parking lot of Blue Rock Springs Park around midnight when another vehicle pulled into the lot, and then that car left, but it came back a few minutes later. The driver then got out of the car, shined a light into Darlene's car, and then he started firing into it with a 9mm handgun. Michael was shot in the jaw, the shoulder, and the leg, and Darlene was shot multiple times all over her body. The next afternoon, a man called the Vallejo police from a gas station payphone, and he claimed responsibility for the shooting as well as the murders of Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday from 6 months earlier. The caller spoke in an emotionless voice, and he said, quote, "I want to report a murder. If you will go 1 mile east on Columbus Parkway, you'll find kids in a brown car. They were shot with a 9mm Luger. I also killed those kids last year. Goodbye." And then he hung up. Oh, how sweet. Is it sweet?
I mean, he gave him a phone call. He wanted him to know.
I think, but you could argue, though, that he was just taking credit. Because at that point, people thought it was just, like, a random murder, the ones earlier. And I think he knew that if he killed these people 6 months later, it would be seen as just another random attack. So this was his way of connecting the two so that people would start to realize it was a serial killer situation.
Okay, fair.
Or you could think maybe he was being sweet.
I mean, I think both of our opinions are correct.
Zodiac Killer's such a cutie. Aww.
Stop.
No, it's bad. I hate those people who, like, that's, like, a real thing, though. Like, people have, like, Instagrams and stuff dedicated to just, like, fangirling over serial killers.
Oh, my God, I know. They have, like, I've seen Ted Bundy Twitters.
I have literally seen people do this shit where they, like, will, like, make fan edits of the freaking kids from Columbine. Like, they'll, like, the two killers, they'll put, like, hearts and, like, little flower crowns and stuff on pictures of them. And I'm like, what is happening right now?
Yeah, I've seen that, and it's terrifying.
It's gross. But also, like, makes me worried. Like, I'm like, are you okay? Do you need help? I mean, probably. The answer's probably yes. Most
definitely.
Anyway, so let's not do that about the Zodiac Killer. That's part of the good reason why, like, not knowing who he is good, because you can't have a crush on someone who you don't know.
I mean, I disagree with that statement, but I won't argue it for the sake of trying to defend people who have crushes on serial killers.
Have you seen the freaking, there was somebody who got, like, when Ted Bundy killed somebody, he bit them and left, like, a big bite mark on them, and somebody got his bite mark as a tattoo. That's a, only reaction, just,
That makes me uncomfortable.
It's also just objectively an ugly tattoo. You know what? I'll say it.
I mean, yeah, but I can't really say much because I have a lizard tattooed on my arm.
Okay, the lizard is cute as fuck, though. Like, not even in the same league.
Okay, yeah, that's fair, I guess. But some would consider it a dumbass tattoo.
I guess, but they're dumb.
I mean, I agree.
Anyway, so the police then followed the instructions that the Zodiac gave them, and they found Darlene and Michael. Darlene, unfortunately died on arrival at the hospital, but Michael survived. But investigators were unable to identify any viable suspects, and they kind of sort of stopped investigating. And not that they stopped investigating into it, but they couldn't find any suspects, so they were sort of just like, sucks.
Yeah, that's fair.
On July 31st, so that was on, Darlene was killed on the 4th of July. So this is July 31st of the same month. Three nearly identical letters were sent to the Vallejo Times-Herald, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the San Francisco Examiner. The letters all took credit for the previous two shootings and contained a piece of a 408-symbol cipher puzzle, which the killer claimed, if solved, would reveal his identity. The killer demanded the letters be printed on the front page of all three newspapers, or he would kill, quote, a dozen people over the weekend.
That's a high number.
That's a threat. I feel threatened.
Yeah, that's, like, two or three, okay, that's fine.
Oh my God.
12?
That's how you know he's exaggerating.
Fair.
Because he, so far, not to, like, put it in mathematical terms, but so far he only has a 50, doesn't he? He only has, like, a 50%.
Success rate, yeah, because two out of four of his victims survived.
Although, yeah. So, 12 is a big number. You when you only are 50% successful in your crimes.
So I guess he'd technically only end up killing six people.
Yeah, that's his, that's if he's being reasonable with himself. He's like, I will try to kill a dozen.
However, it will end up being six.
But But anyway, the Chronicle did take that as a threat, and they published their third of the cipher on the next morning's paper with a request from the Vallejo police chief that the killer send more information about their identity to the paper. The threats of more murders over the weekend didn't happen, and the other two papers eventually also published the rest of the cipher. So he didn't end up killing anybody. About a week later, the Examiner received an additional 3-page letter that started, it said, "Dear Editor, this is the Zodiac speaking, and this is the first use of the name Zodiac," and then people started calling him the Zodiac Killer. The letter was a response to the Vallejo police chief's request for more information, and in it, the Zodiac alluded info about the murders that had not been released to the public, as well as continuing to urge the police to solve the cipher. Which the cipher eventually was solved. It took 7 days after it was published, but it was solved by a high school teacher named Donald Hardin and his wife, Betty. And the full translated cipher said, so basically he sent in a cipher in 3 parts to these 3 newspapers. And when solved, it says, with some typos, there are typos in the cipher, which is confusing, but it says, quote, "I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all to kill. Something gives me the most thrilling experience. It is even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of this is that when I die, I will be reborn in paradise. And the I have killed will become my slaves." He also doesn't use any punctuation, so this is weird to read. "I will not give you my name because you will try to slow down or stop my collection of slaves for my afterlife." And then there's a bunch of, like, leftover letters in the cipher. So basically it's like he made this cipher, but he made it poorly.
I hate that.
But yeah, translated, that's what it says.
I hate that.
About a month. Yeah, it's not great. Did you ever read The Most Dangerous Game? The book?
No, I don't think so.
I had to read it in high school. Do you know what it is?
No.
It's basically just about this, like, rich guy who owns an island, and he, like...
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that. Never mind.
Yeah, it's like people get shipwrecked on his island, and then he just, like, hunts them down because he's, like, because man is the most dangerous game. So that's what he's referencing. About a month and a half later, on a Saturday... September 27th, college students Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd were having a picnic at Lake Berryessa. A man appeared holding a gun and wearing a hooded costume with a symbol of a circle with a cross through it on his chest, and he told them that he had escaped from prison and he needed their wallets and car. He then bound their wrist with pre-cut lengths of plastic clothesline, and he stabbed Brian in the back 6 times without warning. So he showed up and was like, "I escaped from prison," and then he made this whole thing of, like, tying them up and being like, "I need your car, I need your wallet," and, like, making it seem like he was just robbing them, but then he, like, just randomly started stabbing Brian in the back.
Jesus Christ.
And then he stabbed Cecilia 10 times. The man then walked to Brian's car and drew the crossed circle on the door as his symbol, and then he wrote the date, which was the 27th of September, 69, and then he wrote the time, which was 6:30, and then he wrote the words, "by knife." So it's like he was marking, like, when and where and how he killed them, basically. An hour later, a man called the Napa Police Department from a payphone, and he reported a, quote, double murder. The caller described Brian's car and told the police where to find the bodies, and then he said, "I'm the one who did it," before hanging up. Police found the couple... Yeah, police found the couple alive, but Cecilia died 2 days later from her injuries.
Aww.
So again, it's, like, weird. He, like, kills couples, but he always... like, kills the girl, but, like, doesn't successfully, quote-unquote, kill the guy.
Yeah.
So there was a theory that, like, people... because you know how... I don't know if you've ever watched Criminal Minds. I know that's not, like, exactly, like, police, like, real police investigative work. But in the show, they, like, talk a lot about how, like... there are certain things that killers have, like, some killers, like, all their killings are sexually based and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it was a thing for a while where they were trying to figure out if his killings were sexually based, and some people theorize that they were because he would, like, start to kill the guy, and then he would get so, like, I guess caught up in killing the girl that he would forget to, quote, finish off the guy.
Oh.
Which is gross, but... So, about 2 weeks after the Lake Berryessa killings, on October 11th, 28-year-old Paul Stein was working in San Francisco as a cab driver. That night, Paul picked up a passenger and began driving him to a neighborhood called Presidio Heights. At the intersection of Washington and Cherry, the passenger shot Paul Stein in the head, then ripped off a piece of his shirt. The passenger walked away from the crime scene as witnesses called 911. Police officers who were on their way to the crime scene actually drove past a man who matched the Zodiac Killer's description, who was walking away from the scene, but the police radio actually incorrectly broadcasted the suspect as a black man initially, so the police just ignored him when they walked back.
Okay.
So it's like the police fully drove past the Zodiac Killer, but someone was dumb and announced over the radio that they were looking for a black guy, so they were like, nah, that's not him. But then when they actually went, and because there were a lot of witnesses to this attack, so there were people who gave the police statement, and that's actually where they drew up that kind of famous picture, you know, the one that people were like, that's Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
That's where that one was drawn up. So when you look at that one, apparently the cab driver matched that, like, perfectly. Or not the cab driver, the guy who was walking away from the cab driver attack.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. And then fingerprints were found on the driver's side of the cab that may have belonged to the killer, and a sketch was produced based on descriptions provided by the witnesses who called the police. The case was considered a routine robbery until the San Francisco Chronicle received a letter from the Zodiac that said, "I am the murderer of the taxi driver." The letter came with the missing piece of Paul Stein's shirt with his blood on it to, like, prove that it really was him. The Zodiac denied that he left fingerprints and claimed he had worn a disguise to kill the cab driver, so the police sketch was inaccurate. The Zodiac also confirmed that the police officers had driven past him and mocked them for not catching him. He ended the letter with, quote, "School children make nice targets. I think I shall wipe out a school bus one morning. Just shoot out the front tire and then pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out," end quote.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he went there. And that letter caused a frenzy among parents and police, and, like, the police were monitoring schools. There were armed guards who were, like, accompanying children to and from schools. There were police cars just, like, circling school zones, stuff like that, like, for a while after that letter, because people were just, like, in a mass panic.
Beautiful.
Yep. Then early on October 22nd, 1969, the Oakland Police Department received a phone call from a man who claimed to be the Zodiac. The caller said he would speak on television, but he would only speak with the famous Boston attorney F. Lee Bailey. But he told the operator that he would also accept San Francisco lawyer Melvin Belli in the event that Bailey was unable to appear. Which is weird. But they were able to actually get Melvin Belli to do it. And a few hours later, he was the guest on TV with host Jim Dunbar. A man called the KGO television station, and he would, like, speak a couple words to Melvin and then hang up, and he did that 54 times over the course of the conversation. Some people were like, is he crazy? Which, like, if he's a Zodiac killer, then yes. But also the reason that he was doing that was because he suspected that the police were trying to trace his call, and he was right, they totally were. But because he kept doing that, they couldn't, because I guess you have to keep them on the... Or at least, probably not anymore, but in 1969, you had to have them on the line for a while to be able to trace the call.
Right.
So he would, like, wait until... He would just, like, be on the phone for, like, 30 seconds and then be like, got a blast. So he told them that he was the Zodiac, but he said that Melvin could call him Sam. And they just kind of talked for a while about, like... He said he had headaches, he kind of expressed guilt for killing people and sort of made it seem like... He was only killing them because, like, voices in his head were telling him to do it and stuff. I think he said he would meet Belli, but it never ended up happening. Like, he didn't show up for the meeting.
That's rude.
Rude. Ghosted. On November 8th, the Chronicle received a letter containing another piece of the cab driver's shirt, as well as a greeting card and a new cipher that had 340 symbols. In the letter, the Zodiac asks the paper to put the cipher on their front page, saying, quote, "I get awfully lonely when I am ignored. So lonely I could do my thing." He wrote "thing" in all caps with, like, 6 exclamation points.
Jesus.
The writer added, DES, July, August, September, October equals 7, which possibly referenced more unidentified victims. The next day, the Chronicle received a 7-page letter from the Zodiac saying, among other things, that the police stopped him at a crime scene but let him go, and he also included a diagram he had drawn on how to build a bomb.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Then on December 20th, so it's been about a year since his first killing, Melvin Belli received a letter from the Zodiac. The letter wished him a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and the Zodiac asked Belli for help, saying, quote, "I cannot reach out for help because of this thing in me won't let me. I'm finding it extremely difficult to hold it in check. I am afraid I will lose control again and take my 9th and possibly 10th victim. Please help me, I'm drowning."
Oh my God.
I don't know why he felt like he could find comfort in this, like, random attorney, but he did for some reason.
I mean, you know, whatever works.
Yeah, I guess, like, find your people. The Zodiac then goes on to say that he has not finished his bomb, so the school children are safe, but if he does not get help, he will finish the bomb. Over the holidays, Belli's residents also received several phone calls from a man claiming to be the Zodiac. Belli's housekeeper spoke to the man, who said he must kill because it's his birthday, before hanging up. On a Sunday in late March, 22-year-old Kathleen Johns packed her infant daughter into a station wagon and left San Bernardino, California, to visit her mother in Petaluma in the northern part of California. I've never been to California, so I don't know where these places are, but maybe someone will. And she was also 7 months pregnant at the time. As she drove on Highway 132 near Modesto, California, another car pulled beside her and the driver began signaling Kathleen to pull over. Which, first of all, I told you already, Chris, but, like, this morning I was in my car in the Starbucks parking lot, waiting to go into the drive-thru, and this man, who I think was smoking a blunt, it might have been a cigar, I couldn't tell, but he, like, came up and started gesturing at me through the window, and I was just like, nuh-uh, not today.
Not getting murdered today, thank you, though.
If some random person starts gesturing at me to, like, pull over, roll down my window, whatever, like, I'm sorry, no.
I once had a man run in front of my car while I was at a red light and just, like, try and not let me move.
I hate that. I was driving, so when I go to work, I, like, drive under this big bridge that's basically, like, an overpass for I-4.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, like, homeless people under there, and a lot of the times they, like, have signs and stuff, and that's fine. But there was this one guy who he, like, came over to my car and was, like, knocking on my window and then being, like, making, like, motion for me to give him money, and I genuinely did not have any cash or anything, so I was just like, I'm sorry. Like, I just kind of, like, shrugged, and I was like, I'm sorry, I don't have anything. And then he literally, like, got down on his knees and started, like, making begging motions for me to give him money, but he was, like, being very aggressive, and I was like, I have nothing.
Oh my God, that's a lot.
It was very stressful. I was like, I'm sorry, sir, please get off the ground. But then he, like, eventually stood up and then went to the car behind me and started doing the exact same thing. So I'm like, is this just, like, your vibe?
Is that the act? Is that what's going on? Is this your show?
I guess. I don't know. It was very aggressive and stressful. I don't like when people touch my car when I'm inside of it.
Yeah, that's understandable.
Anyway, so let this be a lesson to you all. If people are, like, gesturing at you, I don't care if your car is on fire. Do not pull over.
Yeah.
But Kathleen pulled over. And after she did, the driver came to her window and told her that the back wheel of her station wagon was wobbling and that he thought it was loose. And he said he had tools in his car and could fix it for her. And she was just like, okay, because I guess chivalry was alive and well at that time. And she thought he was just being a good Samaritan. But, like, I feel like you can feel it if your tire is loose.
Yeah.
But she didn't, apparently, and she was just like, okay, yeah, fix my car, random man. So he got out of his car and started, quote, fixing her car. But instead of fixing it, he actually loosened the lug nuts on her car, and then he got back in his car and appeared to drive away. She started to drive away, but then the wheels fell off her car.
Oh my God.
The man then pulled back around and offered to drive her to the gas station, which is like, I get that she probably had a lot going on. Her mom was sick. She had this baby. She was pregnant. She didn't have another, I guess there weren't cell phones, obviously, so it's not like she could call an Uber, like, but, it, like, this man obviously just took the wheels off your car, so maybe don't get in the car with him.
Yeah, it's valid.
But she did. And then once he passed the gas station, Kathleen realized he was dangerous, which, like, I'm not trying to victim blame Kathleen. I get it. Situations. I just am kind of, like, stranger danger.
Yeah.
But according to Kathleen, the man then began threatening her daughter. So Kathleen, like, held her daughter against her chest and then just opened the door and jumped from the moving car. Which, like, badass move. Another passing driver saw Kathleen and her daughter do this, and they took her to the police station. Which, like, I can't imagine almost getting kidnapped and then getting in another stranger's car.
Yeah.
Like, I know it... I know at that point it's like you don't have options, but, like, the story's just wild. So she gave the police her identification, and it matched the Zodiac police sketch. A few months later, the Zodiac mentioned giving the woman a ride in one of his letters, but it's still unconfirmed if this was a Zodiac incident, as some police officers believe that the Zodiac often took credit for crimes he didn't commit because he would wait for they, like, matched up the timeline of hit, like, killings that happened and then when he would take credit for them. And with, like, some killings, like the canonical ones, he took credit for them and, like, had information that other people wouldn't. But in other ones, he would take credit for things after they were reported on, and he would only say things that were also reported on. So some people think he was, like, trying to up his numbers by taking credit for things he didn't actually do.
Ew.
And because, like, there's a lot of stuff he took credit for that didn't really fit his MO, basically.
Yeah.
The Zodiac sent two letters in April, one including a new cipher and a new bomb diagram, and the other had a greeting card with bomb threats and asking members of the public to start wearing Zodiac buttons with his logo, which is weird. Like, why are you trying to sell merch? He then sent another letter in June with a map of San Francisco and a crossed circle on the peak of Mount Diablo with a code to locate a bomb that he allegedly planted.
Mm.
He also stated that he took another victim since his letter in April, although it's unknown if that's true or who the victim would have been because no one was identified. He then sent another letter in July complaining that no one was wearing his Zodiac buttons. Which is, like, obviously he's a serial killer. I'm not trying to be like, oh, but, like, it's just weirdly endearing that he's like, I just want people to wear my buttons.
Yeah.
Not, like, endearing. Like, it's not cute. It's just like, what the fuck is happening?
No, I understand. I get it.
Yeah. And then in this letter, he also claimed responsibility for Kathleen John's failed abduction. And then he sent another 5-page letter to the Chronicle in July. The Chronicle received 4 more letters over the next few months, including a postcard dated March 22nd in 1971 with an ad for a condominium project in Lake Tahoe, Nevada, with the phrases, past Lake Tahoe areas and sought victim 12. Some believe that this was a clue to the disappearance of 25-year-old Donna Lass, who had disappeared in May of 1970. At the time, Donna worked in San Francisco at Letterman General Hospital, near where the Zodiac killed the cab driver. Donna moved northeast to South Lake Tahoe and found work as a nurse for the Sahara Hotel and Casino. On September 6th, 1970, Donna vanished sometime after the last entry in her work logbook at 1:50 a.m. Her car was later found abandoned near her apartment, and according to some accounts, an unidentified man called Donna's employer and her landlord claiming that she had to leave town due to a family emergency. But Donna's family told authorities that there wasn't an emergency and the man was never identified. Investigators suspected Donna had been abducted and killed, but her body was never found, and her disappearance remains a mystery, and her name was added to a long list of possible Zodiac victims.
Aww. That makes me sad.
Yeah. Honestly, it makes me even sadder, like, the victims who are maybes, because it's, like, I can't imagine, like, your family member getting killed, and then it's just, like, you never get any answers.
Right.
I was watching the, like, I know this is very different, but I was watching, like, the People versus O.J. Simpson with Alex, and, like, it fucks me up, because, like, I feel like obviously he did it, but, like, if he didn't do it, it's, like, who did it?
Right.
And that always messes me up when there's, like, an unsolved murder, because I'm like, somebody killed them? Who? But anyway, after that letter, there were no new ones from the Zodiac until August 1st, 1973. Over 2 years later, when the Albany Times Union newspaper in New York received a letter that read, in all caps, quote, "You are wrong. I'm not dead or in the hospital. I am alive and well, and I'm going to start killing again. Below is the name and location of my next victim, but you had better hurry because I'm going to kill her August 10th at 5 p.m. when the shift change. Albany is a nice town." Below the message, the writer included three rows of symbols. In, according to an FBI report, the coded message read, "Albany Medical Center, this is only the beginning. Investigators were unable to identify any murders that took place on August 10th. Handwriting experts were unable to determine if the handwriting was a match to the letters received by the Chronicle, but 5 months later, on January 29th of 1974, the Chronicle received their final Zodiac letter, where he praised the movie The Exorcist and called it, quote, the best satirical comedy he had ever seen, and he claimed that he had a total of 37 victims.
Okay.
This dude's really just, like, sending in movie reviews at this point.
Yeah.
That was the first, like, last canonical letter from him, but the Chronicle did receive three other letters that seemed to match Zodiac handwriting, but it hasn't been confirmed. One was in February. The reason all of these are, like, maybes is because they weren't signed by the Zodiac, like all of his other letters. One in February was signed a friend, another in May was signed a citizen, and the final letter in July was signed the Red Phantom.
Okay.
Over the course of this time, the Chronicle received 22 letters in total determined to be from the Zodiac between 1969 and 1974. Although the Zodiac claimed to have 37 victims, and there is, an insane list of possible victims, all that we know for sure is that the Zodiac had 27 victims in total, two of whom survived, and all of which took place in the year of 1969.
Jesus.
So, let me tell you the suspects.
Do it. I'm ready.
So, the first suspect is a man named Lawrence Kane. So, first I'm going to tell you why he's suspected. So Kane worked in the same Lake Tahoe hotel as Donna Lass, who was the woman who disappeared in 1970 and who some think might have been a Zodiac victim, but her body was never found.
Mm-hmm.
He served in the Naval Reserves, where he might have learned coding, and he was in a car accident in 1962 that left him with a brain injury that some people said made him prone to violent outbursts.
Oh, okay.
In 1961, he was arrested for peeping, and then he was arrested again for prowling in 1969, which I don't know what prowling entails.
Peeping
is it, like,
and
trespassing?
Prowling. Probably.
Peeping and prowling?
I feel like
a prowler.
Prowling is, like, trespassing and peeping.
Okay, so peeping is just peeping. Prowling is peeping plus trespassing.
Yeah.
Potentially. There was a retired police detective who investigated the case in the 80s, and he claimed to have found the name Lawrence Kane written in one of the Zodiac ciphers.
Mm.
He also claimed that the sister of the Zodiac's first victim, Darlene Farron, had identified a photo of Kane. So, well, not his first victim, actually. Betty Lou was his first victim, but in his second attack, Darlene Farron, who he killed, her sister identified Kane. Saying that Darlene's sister claimed that Kane came to a restaurant that Darlene worked at and he would constantly bother her. And then one of the police officers who passed the Zodiac after the murder of cab driver Paul Stein said that Lawrence Kane's photos was the most similar to the man that he saw. And Lawrence Kane only lived a few blocks away from Paul Stein where Paul Stein was killed. And Kathleen Johns, who was the girl who escaped from the car, also identified a photo of Kane as her abductor.
Mm.
However, he was much older than most of the witnesses identified, for all the other, like, canonical, like, victims. And some doctors believe that his mental disability was too severe for him to pull off being the Zodiac without being caught. His fingerprints, handwriting, and DNA also didn't match any of the Zodiacs, so he was cleared by police.
Oh.
He was also a suspect in the murder of a young woman named Dana Lull in Nevada in 1974. Dana Lull was determined to not be a Zodiac murder, but her murder was similar to the disappearance of Donna Lass, the other possible Zodiac victim. So some people believe that Lawrence Kane wasn't the Zodiac, but he did kill Donna Lass and attempted to kidnap Kathleen Johns, and then the Zodiac took credit for it.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so some people think he was a murderer and a kidnapper, but he wasn't the Zodiac.
Okay.
Because, like, the Zodiac claimed to have killed 37 people, but only 7 people were confirmed.
Right.
Another possible suspect is a man named Ross Sullivan. So in 1966, 18-year-old Cherry Jo Bates was murdered on campus at Riverside City College in Riverside, California. Her murder remains unsolved to this day, but she is considered a possible Zodiac victim. Staffers at the Riverside City College Library, near where her body was found, named their coworker Ross Sullivan as a possible suspect in her murder. His coworkers said he had always made them uncomfortable and that he disappeared for several days after Cherry Jo Bates' murder. Sullivan also had a crew cut and glasses similar to the police sketch of the Zodiac. He moved to Northern California in 1967, right before the Zodiac killing started, and he was hospitalized several times for bipolar disorder and schizophrenia.
Oh.
Sullivan often wore military-style boots that matched the footprints that were left at Lake Berryessa, and the Zodiac also mentioned the opera The Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan in his letters, which might have been a possible clue to the last name Sullivan, because the Zodiac liked to play little dumb games like that.
Yeah.
He also became quite sick and was moved into a care facility around the same time that the Zodiac letters stopped. However, all of this is circumstantial, and there's no evidence actually tying him to the victims who we know were Zodiac victims. There's only evidence tying him to a possible victim.
Okay.
He was also much, like, larger than most of the witnesses described the Zodiac being. Another suspect is a man named Richard Marshall, who was a radio operator and movie projectionist who lived in Riverside, California in 1966, and then he later moved to San Francisco near where Paul Stein was murdered. Visitors to his home told police they found him, like, weird, and that he talked about finding something much more exciting than sex. Marshall lived near Riverside during the possible Zodiac murder of Cherry Jo Bates, and there's also evidence that he was near Lake Berryessa during the time of the stabbings. Marshall was a big fan of ciphers and codes, and he also liked old movies, including The Red Phantom and The Most Dangerous Game, which were both mentioned in the Zodiac letters and ciphers. He lived in a basement apartment, which was also mentioned in a Zodiac letter. He owned a typewriter and a teletype similar to those the Zodiac used. They both liked felt-tipped pens and odd-sized paper. Richard Marshall also had a similar appearance to the police sketch, and he owned some of the same types of weapons that the Zodiac used, and his handwriting was also very similar to the Zodiac's. All of the evidence against him was circumstantial, though, and he was cleared by police because his fingerprints didn't match the partial print taken from Paul Stein's cab.
Ah.
Here I will give you kind of a dumb one.
Good.
There's a man named Earl Van Best Jr., who in 2014, a man named Gary Stewart wrote a book called The Most Dangerous Animal of All, in which he made a case that his dad, Earl Van Best, was the Zodiac. Stewart said that his dad resembled the composite sketch of the Zodiac. He lived in California at the time of the killings. He was interested in ciphers. He knew a Satanist, and he was friends with a member of the Mason family, and he also liked Gilbert and Sullivan. Best also served time in prison for the statutory rape of Stewart's mother and may have held a grudge against San Francisco Chronicle reporter Paul Avery, who wrote a series of articles about him after he was arrested for raping his wife. Stewart also claimed to have found Best's initials in the Zodiac cipher, and a document examiner said that the handwriting of Best's marriage certificate matched the Zodiac's. Although their fingerprints didn't match, a mark that could have been a scar was visible in Best's fingerprint, and it was also found in the fingerprint in Paul Stein's cab. But pretty much all experts dismissed this case because the method that he used to crack the ciphers was, like, weird and didn't really make sense. The fingerprint mark was similar to the Zodiac's only if it was reversed, and it was actually found that the handwriting on Best's marriage certificate wasn't Best's at all. It was the priest, which implicates that the priest was the Zodiac, not Best. For Best's resemblance, people said that, like, a crew cut and horn rim glasses was, like, a really popular look in the 60s, so that's not really evidence.
Yeah, that makes sense. Best... fair.
And then he died in 1984. So it seems like this guy just, like, his dad was a horrible person, and his dad raped his mom, and he held a grudge about it, and then was like, I think my dad's the Zodiac Killer.
Okay.
Which, like, honestly, I get it. Like, if your dad's that shitty, I could be like, yeah, I'll implicate him as a serial killer.
Yeah, that's fair.
Another possible suspect was a man named Jack Terrence. This was another, like, basically the same as the last one, where a man named Dennis Kaufman claimed that his dead stepfather, Jack Terrence, was the Zodiac. Kaufman said Terrence was a dead ringer for the composite sketch and claimed to have a stash of incriminating evidence, including a roll of film depicting possible victims and a bizarre hooded costume like the one that the Zodiac wore during the Lake Berryessa stabbings. On a 2007 Discovery Channel documentary, a document examiner said that Terrence's handwriting also matched the Zodiac, but law enforcement officials dismissed Kaufman's evidence as nonsense because he also claimed that his dad killed the Black Dahlia. And people said that the hooded costume that he had didn't actually look that much like the one that the victims described and that he might have just, like, made it himself. And researchers also challenged the credibility of the document examiner because the document examiner also believed that this man not only was the Zodiac Killer, not only killed the Black Dahlia, but also had written the JonBenet Ramsey ransom note.
He's just done a lot.
And then the Jack Terrence. Yeah, so they just think he did everything ever. He's every serial killer.
Okay.
And then he died in 2006. So he's off the table. Okay, so the last suspect that I will give you is the suspect that Robert Graysmith, who wrote the book Zodiac and who the movie Zodiac follows. This is who he is dead set on. This guy is the Zodiac Killer. And honestly, I'm probably biased because I like the movie The Zodiac, but I think he's right. This one just kind of makes the most sense, but there's a lot of, like, I briefly peered into the Zodiac Killer subreddit, and it is an active community of people who are still desperately trying to solve the crime. And a lot of people in that community are like, this guy's not the Zodiac Killer. So I don't know, but this guy, I think, has the most evidence towards him. It's a guy named Arthur Lee Allen. He was accused by his friend Don Chaney of being the Zodiac in 1969. Chaney told the police that he and Allen had gone fishing, and Allen had told him his elaborate plan to kill people with a flashlight on his gun and go by the name the Zodiac. He also had a Zodiac brand watch with the symbol that the Zodiac used in his letters, and he also owned the same caliber gun used in the Zodiac shootings and was seen with bloody knives in his car. Although his defense for this was that he said that the knives were used to kill chickens.
Okay.
He had been dishonorably discharged from the Navy, and he had been fired from his job as a school teacher for sexual misconduct. And he had been accused of being a pedophile.
Ah.
His brother and sister-in-law also had cards and letters from Alan where he misspelled common words in similar ways to how the Zodiac did. Like, a big example was that the Zodiac wrote Christmas with two S's at the end, and then Arthur Lee Allen did the same thing in his, like, Christmas cards. A friend of Alan reported to the police that he had built bombs in his house, and he lived close to where victim Darlene Farran worked and was near Lake Berryessa on the day of the stabbings, and his shoes also matched the footprint left by the Zodiac at the crime scene. His favorite book was The Most Dangerous Game, which was mentioned by the Zodiac in his first cipher, and he also, this is, I think, probably the most damning piece of evidence. Not, like, the most damning, but for me, it makes it more real. There was, like, a long period of time where the Zodiac letters stopped, and then they briefly started up again. During that period of time that the, like, if you put the timeline of the letters over the timeline of Arthur Lee Allen's life, the exact same time that the letters stopped, Allen was at was in prison, and then as soon as he got out of prison is when the letters started again.
Mm.
However, Allen was ruled out by police because his DNA, handwriting, and fingerprints were not matches to the Zodiac's. Don Chaney, however, claimed that Allen had a habit. So they got the a brief thing of the Zodiac's DNA by like compositing DNA from the backs of the stamps on the Zodiac letter. But Don Chaney claimed that Allen had other people lick his stamps for him, and apparently Allen was ambidextrous, and some handwriting experts hypothesized that Allen may have written the Zodiac letters with his other hand, and that he would have two different like handwritings for his right and left hand.
Mm.
However, police tested both hands and neither was a match, but some people have another theory that nobody's handwriting is gonna match the Zodiac, because it's possible that the Zodiac, like, has kind of, like, a personality split between his, like, real self and when he's the Zodiac. And apparently there's, like, psychological evidence to suggest that, like, if you have a personality split, one personality can have a different handwriting than another personality.
Oh, that's,
which I think has actually been, like, proven. Like, they have people who have dissociative identity disorder, and when they're in different identities, they have different handwritings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a possible, yeah, it's, like, really interesting. It's also, like, we can talk more about that later, because I could talk about this all day, but there's also evidence to show, like, one person, but they have dissociative identity disorder, one identity will, like, need glasses, but then when they're in a different identity, they have a completely different prescription, or they don't need glasses at all.
That's wild.
Isn't that crazy?
It really is.
But yeah, so that's a theory that some people have. Another bit of evidence is in Robert Graysmith's book, he also states that Melvin Belly's housekeeper spoke to the Zodiac before Christmas when he said, "I need to kill, it's my birthday." And Arthur Lee Allen's birthday was December 18th, close to when that call would have taken place.
Mm-hmm.
There's some, like, disputing that, because some people, like, Robert Graysmith is like, that call was from the Zodiac, but some people have said that that call wasn't from the Zodiac, because I guess they tried to trace the call and it traced to a mental hospital patient who couldn't have been the Zodiac because he was, like, incarcerated.
Oh, nice.
However, the letter that Belly received was, like, definitively determined to have been from the Zodiac, so there's some, like, disagreement about whether Melvin Belly was actually in contact with him or not. But if he was in contact with him, he actually did call on his birthday and said, "It's my birthday," and it was Arthur Lee Allen's birthday that day. So that's, like, a piece of evidence that Robert Graysmith uses as, like, his, what's the word, his, like, damning piece of evidence, his, like, smoking gun, if you will.
Mm.
Police investigated Allen in 1969 and 1971, where they cleared him based on his fingerprints and handwriting. They began investigating him again in 1991 after a man facing armed robbery charges claimed that Allen had told him he killed the cab driver. So basically in the 90s, a man who had been Allen's cellmate told police that he had confessed to killing the cab driver while in prison. So when that happened, this was in 1991, so it was 22 years after the attack, but they showed Michael Magoo, who had survived the Vallejo attack, a picture of Alan, and he identified him as the Zodiac. So after that identification, that's like, I guess all of the evidence against him was circumstantial at that point, so they weren't able to make an arrest. But after he was identified by a victim, they started like looking for more that they could use to arrest him. Mm-hmm. But he died in 1992 before he could be investigated any further.
Oh.
And some investigators actually believe now that the fingerprint that was found in Paul Stein's cab might not have even belonged to the Zodiac at all. So it's possible, and like that fingerprint is what they used to rule out all of these suspects. So pretty much every suspect that they ever looked into might have been the Zodiac, because they used like small pieces of DNA and a fingerprint that might not have even been his.
Beautiful. I love it.
So doesn't that make you feel great?
It makes me feel so good. I'm just very excited.
Very excited to know. Oh, I forgot one suspect. This suspect is named Ted Cruz.
I hate you.
I just like fully went into an analysis of why Ted Cruz is the Zodiac Killer.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, but I would just, you know.
My favorite thing on the planet was like during that election, like people would be at his rallies just holding up signs being like, "You are the Zodiac Killer." And he like very earnestly was like, "No, I'm not. I wasn't even alive."
And they're like, "Nope, you, Ted Cruz, you are the Zodiac Killer. Sorry."
It's just like he didn't understand what a meme was.
He was like,
"Why do these people think I'm the Zodiac Killer?"
And you'd be like, "Well, you are."
Sucks to suck. Anyway, so that is the story of the Zodiac Killer. I'm sure I left out a lot of stuff, but I was talking for a million years as it was, so I think I kept in everything that I could have kept in.
That's a very
long story involving a lot of letters and a lot of suspects and a lot of victims, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mine's kind of long, too, but I don't think it'll be this long. I want to take quick little break before we get into mine.
Yeah, let's take a breather. You can process the Zodiac, determine who you think the killer was. I think it's Ted, but, you know, we all have our opinions.
Ted Bundy is the Zodiac killer. Send tweet.
Oh, my God.
I said Ted Bundy. I meant Ted Cruz.
I know, but I'm kind of like, yeah, let's just keep that. It's Ted Bundy.
Ted Bundy is the Zodiac killer.
Ted Bundy also killed JonBenet Ramsey.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
Send tweet. End podcast.
Podcast over. My story, not relevant.
Okay, let's take that break.
All right. We're back. Part two, because my mic turned off.
Wait.
Did you say wait?
No, I...
Okay.
I started to talk and then I realized I didn't know what I was saying, so I stopped.
All right, sounds that's mostly what I end up doing, honestly.
The issue with recording these podcasts is whenever I go first, I feel like my brain has a limited capacity of talking that I'm allowed to do in a certain amount of time. So when I tell my story, I like hit my quota, and then by the time we come back from the break, I'm like, I need to be funny now, and I'm just like, hey.
I actually had a teacher who used to tell me that I could only have a certain number of words a day because I talked a lot.
Oh my God.
And so she would have a limit of how much I could talk, and she would just at random points during the day say I've reached my limit and I was no longer allowed to keep talking.
And you're just like, damn, okay.
Yeah. I was like, well, shit. All right.
I was talking to my friend Lily about this the other day, how like, I mean, I was never the person in school who, like, really talked during class or anything like that, but I always thought it was funny how, like, in school, if you talk during class and, like, make jokes and are funny and stuff, people, like, think you're cool. Like, that makes you cool, sort of. But in college, if you were to, like, talk or, like, try to make jokes during class, people would literally think you're a psychopath.
Oh, 100%. So,
like, they'd be like, shut up. What are you doing?
Did I tell you what happened in my class a few weeks ago?
No.
Oh, my God. Okay, so...
Oh, wait, the thing with the... Where people, they thought you were high?
Yeah.
Tell the listeners.
Okay, so I'm in a nursing assistant class right now, and we... I have, like, a group of, like, four or five people. Like, no, four of the people that, like, we just, like, kind of get along, and we joke around, and, like, we do the stuff together, because it's a lot of work, and so, like, we just do it together. Mm-hmm. And so... A few weeks ago, we get pulled aside at the beginning of our lab, and they're like, we need to talk to you. And we were like, okay, maybe it's because we were a little too loud last week, because, like, we got finished really early. And so we just, like, sat up front in the class for the next... We finished before break started. And then after the break, we still had another 2 hours of class. And so, we finished before break, and so we just sat up front the rest of class talking. And so, I were like, maybe we were just, you know, a little too loud, like, whatever, fine.
Yeah.
And so we go to the back, and the, like, director of the program is there. And I'm like, okay, cool. What the fuck do you want? Yeah. And then, so she proceeds to tell us that we're being brought up back because all of our instructors have, believed that we come to class high after our break. That we go out to my car on our 10-minute break, mind you. And all five of us get stoned as fuck and then come back into class. And their reasoning for that is we were laughing, talking to each other, and not able to focus on our work.
But is that true? Like, are you able to focus on your work?
Yes. I've gotten an A on all three exams so far, and our group is the first one to check off on literally anything in lab.
Then that's so weird. Like, you have no evidence.
Right. And then so... We were all pissed. Like, I was, like, calling her out, and I was like, so, are you saying that I'm not allowed to laugh in this class anymore?
Yeah.
And she's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm like, no, it kind of is, because your only grounds for this accusation is the fact that we were laughing. So, the next time I laugh in this class, is someone going to accuse me of being high again? And then am I going to get kicked out of the class because I'm laughing? And she's like, well, no, we're just letting you know what the policy is again. And I was like, we know what the policy is. However, you're saying that we seemed high because we were laughing. So the next time I laugh, are you going to think I'm high? And so we were, like, all kind of pissed. And we were, like, really pissed at one of our lab instructors because, like, he was really cool and, like, joked around with us all the time and everything. And we're like, damn, he reported us. We're going to just fucking, like... do our shit and not, like, joke around with him anymore. But then...
Yeah, because if, like, joking around means that you're, like, high and not taking class seriously.
Right, exactly. And so, like, then he sees that we're all pissed because we're just not participating. Like, they're trying to go over stuff, and usually we're, like, the group that's, like, participating and shit, and we're just not saying a single word. And so he's like, can I talk to you five outside? And he's like, I just want you to know that I didn't accuse you of anything. He's like, one of your classmates narked, and they told each one of the instructors, and that's the only reason this thing is being brought forward. And I was like, who the fuck was it?
Yeah.
And he obviously wouldn't tell us, but he was like, this happens every year, people aren't friends with the cool kids, and they get jealous, and so they make up lies about them to get them in trouble.
Aw, you're the cool kid.
And I'm like, I'm one of the cool kids?
Look at you go.
And, like, that shit doesn't happen. But we were all, like, livid.
No, that's annoying.
Especially because, like, it was really funny, because only two out of the five of us even smoke.
Yeah, so it's like...
Like, one of them is still in high school. Like, he's, like, 18 and still in high school.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, I haven't even drank yet.
He's like, I'm just here to have a good time.
Right, he's like, I'm just trying to get this certificate, bud. Like, I don't know what you're yelling at me for.
Yeah.
It was a wild time. I hate that class. Listen, anyway, we're going to talk about death now.
Is it death?
Nope. Well, kind of. Just listen.
Okay, I'm listening.
I'm going to tell you the story of Mary Vincent.
Okay.
Do you know anything about that?
I don't.
Beautiful.
I don't even know what the words you just said are.
Mary Vincent?
Oh, Mary Vincent. I thought you said, like, mirror something.
Okay. No. Mary Vincent.
Okay, if this is a human person.
Yes, it is. This is not the story about how Amir almost got murdered. Unfortunately, because that would be a good story.
That'd be bomb AF.
Well, however, this is not bomb AF. So, here we go.
That sounded like such a, like, freaking, I can't think of words today. My brain is melting. Like, in, those, like, don't smoke videos that they, PSAs that they show kids and stuff.
Oh my god, like, yeah.
You know what's not lit?
Marijuana.
Smoking. Anyway, tell me about Mary.
I will tell you about Mary. So on a September day in 1978, Mary Vincent was 15 years old and was hitchhiking across California to her grandfather's house in Corona, California.
Why is a 15-year-old hitchhiking? I have questions.
Because she was an average teenager with average teenage problems. And that's a full quote from a website that I was researching this from.
Wait, what year is this?
78.
Okay.
So, she was a good dancer, and so she could have had a career with dancing. And she did okay in school, but she skipped a lot. She wanted to run away from home because her parents were about to get a divorce, and she was just over it. She was like, gotta go, gotta blast.
Yeah.
She was described as dangerously naive and was just looking for ways to rebel. Those are both, like, quotes used to describe her.
That makes sense. Like, that's how teenagers are, like, if their parents are getting divorced.
Usually. Right, exactly. So she was cutting class, wearing makeup, which, like, you know, they considered scandalous and everything. How dare she? And had run away before. One summer, she had even lived with her boyfriend in a car, but that ended when he was arrested for allegedly raping a young girl.
Oh my god.
When she wasn't home or living in cars or hitchhiking, she would often crash at her uncle's house. So, like, that's where she was going, to her uncle. So she stood in with a group of other hitchhikers on the side of the road, and a blue van pulled up. And the driver of the van only offered a ride to her, saying he didn't have room for everyone else. Everyone else that people that Mary was standing with was, like, protesting, saying that she shouldn't go alone with him. She's actually also on, side note, this story is on an episode of I Survived.
Oh, okay. So she's alive.
Yeah.
Good to know.
And so this is what she said. This is a quote from her. She said she was just tired of being alone and was just tired. And so she got in the car with him. This man was Lawrence Singleton, an average, unsuspecting, grandfatherly type of man. He had a beer belly and a kind face. He was headed to Reno, but offered her a ride to LA, even though it was a detour from where he was actually going.
I trust no man's.
Especially this one. So a little backstory about him. He was born July 28th, 1927 in Tampa, Florida.
So no!
Congratulations to you.
I'm from there.
I know. He
There's
was married.
A lot of bad people from there, actually.
Yeah. He was married twice, divorced twice, and had a daughter. However, his relationship with his daughter was rough, and they were always, like, fighting and everything. So, back to Mary being in this man's car.
Okay.
So.
I don't want to go back there.
Well, I'm sorry. We have to.
Okay.
Mary lit
I know she survived. It's okay.
Right. I wish I wouldn't have said that, because I wanted you to build up the suspense, but, like, at the same time, like, I had written it the way I did, and the quote was already there, and I was like, god damn it.
No, I feel you.
Anyway, so Mary lit a cigarette in the car. She's 15, mind you, so, like, girl.
It's the 70s. There's
no I guess, rules. Yeah. She sneezed, and Singleton reached for her and pulled her closer so he could see if she was sick.
Ew, what? No.
But she pulled away and, like, sat against the door, so he couldn't reach her anymore. As they were continuing to drive, he decided he needed to stop by his house in San Francisco to pick up some laundry. He had to make a pit stop to pick up clothes.
Okay.
And she even helped him bring all of the laundry out to the van.
What a kind soul.
I know. Once they were back on the road, she fell asleep, and he began to drink liquor out of a milk carton.
I have a lot of questions.
Yeah. He had a serious drinking problem. When he was sober, he was a kind old man, but he would be mean as shit whenever he was drunk. Later, Mary woke up from her nap, and she saw a road sign that indicated they were heading the opposite direction of where she was going. So yeah, she realized they were going the wrong way. And so she confronted him, and he claimed it was an honest mistake, and he agreed to turn around. But it was after sunset now. So, they've been driving for a good minute. He then pulled his van over on the side of the road so he could take a break to pee. Mary also got out to pee and get to from some fresh air, but when she bent down to tie her shoe, she was hit over the head with a hammer. Oh, Lawrence Singleton then yelled at her, "Don't scream or I'll kill you."
It's weird that he would wait so long to, like, do something.
Right. He then dragged her body.
She was, like, asleep.
Right, exactly. Like, that was... Well, because he wasn't drunk then yet, remember? He was, like, getting drunk as it happened. So, whenever she woke up...
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
He drug her body to the back of the van and shoved it in, the inside. This is where it gets bad. So, I'm just warning you.
Okay.
He tied her hands behind her back and then proceeded to brutally rape and sodomize her. After the initial assault, he moved the van down into the canyon, butt-ass naked. He then cut the ties that were binding her hands together and forced her to drink his liquor that was in the milk carton, which again is fucking weird as shit.
Yeah, like, why would you empty out a milk carton and that? Never mind.
he said he would set her free if she just continued to cooperate. After multiple assaults and continuous drinks of the alcohol, she passed out. But she wasn't out for long, and once she woke up, he instructed her to lie on the ground. He then cut off both of her arms with a hatchet while she was conscious and completely aware of everything that was happening.
Oh my god.
Then he pushed her limp body down into the canyon. He assumed she and left her for dead, basically. And he thought that no one would ever find the body. Yeah.
Why would he just chop her arms off?
Because he's a shitty man.
I know, but, like, what a weird way to try to kill someone.
Yeah. But she knew that if she didn't survive to tell her story, more people would get hurt or killed by this man.
Mm-hmm.
So she rolled her severed arms around in dirt to make mud to cover her wounds to stop the bleeding. She then made her way back up the hill, guiding her way back to the freeway, listening to the sounds of traffic. Once she was back on the road, she walked with the rest of what like remained of her arm stumps in the air so her muscles and blood wouldn't fall out.
Oh my god. Like, what a badass. But like, right. Oh my god.
Also, like, just remember, she's also naked still at this time.
And 15 years old.
Right.
That's insane.
As she walked along the road, a red convertible with two men inside slowed down, but once they got a look at her, they sped off, either not hearing or ignoring her screaming for help. But also, let's be fair, what would you do if you saw a naked girl covered in blood without arms? Just on the side of the highway.
I feel like I would think it was a ghost.
Right, exactly.
I mean, like... That's how I always feel when I, like, read these stories where it's, like, and then no one helped. And I'm, like, I try to, like, think about what I would do. And obviously, like, now, like, we have the benefit, like, I would obviously call 911. But, like, we have the benefit of having cell phones. So, like, we can take a more hands-off approach.
That's be, fair. Like,
yeah. But, like, then, like, the only thing they could really do is be, like, okay, get in the car.
Right.
Which is, like, a lot. That's,
yeah, exactly. The next morning, two women drove by, and like it was by pure luck because they were just they were driving around because they were lost. All that she could say was, "He raped me." They wrapped her in towels and placed her in the car where they drove to a nearby airport and called for an ambulance. She received urgent medical attention, where they had to take out pieces of her leg to save the remainder of her arms. So, at this point now, she's never going to be able to dance again.
Oh, I forgot she was a dancer.
Yeah. But she gave a thorough description of Lawrence Singleton, and a composite sketch was drawn. And Singleton's neighbor recognized him and called the cops immediately.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah. He told the police that Mary was a sex worker and he hadn't done anything to her. Someone else had been in the car with him and they had done it. And that she had threatened him by saying if he didn't give her a ride that she would call the cops and say he raped her. And to top it all off, he called her a $10 a night whore. Yeah. Before facing him in trial, she was fitted with prosthetics, but obviously was having difficulty with it because she was 15 and now has, like, hooks for arms.
Yeah.
However, even though Singleton received the maximum sentence, it was only 14 years.
Oh my god.
He was charged with kidnapping, mayhem, attempted murder, forcible rape, sodomy, and forced oral copulation.
What does mayhem mean?
I don't know.
I too cause mayhem.
However, I don't need to go to
not
jail
that
for
kind
it.
Of mayhem.
Right. Just crackhead energy mayhem.
Just like good chaos, you know?
Right, exactly. Before being sentenced, he again tried to convince everyone that it was the other hitchhikers who committed the crime, but no one believed him, and he was ordered to pay $2.56 million to Mary in a civil judgment.
Nice.
However, he was unemployed and couldn't afford that, so she only ended up getting $200.
Damn.
But the judge who sentenced him said, if I had the power, I would send him to prison for the rest of his life.
Good.
Despite...
Like, how are you going to cut someone's arms off after raping them and then just be like, it wasn't me?
Yeah. Oh, but it gets so much worse. Despite being one of the biggest fucking assholes ever, he was considered a model prisoner while serving his sentence and only ended up serving 8 years and 4 months.
Oh my god.
He was paroled for good behavior and continued to proclaim his innocence.
I feel like you shouldn't be able to get off for good behavior if you're a violent criminal.
Right.
Like, you can get good behavior if you're, like, arrested for, like, drug charges or something. But, like, once you, like, cut someone's arms off, like, I'm sorry, like, you're not allowed to have good behavior anymore.
Right. Before he was released, he was given a psychological evaluation that the doctor said, quote, because he is so out of touch with his own hostility and anger, he remains an elevated threat to others' safety inside and outside of the prison.
Facts.
So there's documentation stating he's a danger to other people, and he was still, like, to be free.
That's fucked up.
So while this was all happening, Mary was attempting to live her life, but she was battling depression, anorexia, and PTSD. And her life just kept, like, spiraling downwards. She was at a school for the handicapped that she hated, and she was seeing a psychiatrist that she stated forced to bring up painful memories that she wasn't ready to deal with. And then she continued to be rebellious against her parents, and then her family eventually got a divorce. Her father, Herb, moved to Alaska, and her mother, Lucy, stayed in Las Vegas. Mary eventually graduated from high school and immediately moved out of Las Vegas and, like, kind of withdrew from society. She became very secretive about her life and location because she never wanted to be found to be, because she was worried that he would track her down. Without steady employment, she couldn't afford to have her prosthetics fixed after they were broken, and then she ultimately filed for bankruptcy. And she was, like, surviving off of donations and, like, welfare, basically. She did happen to get married, but the marriage only lasted for 3 years. Then she met her second husband, Tom, who was an investigator in the prosecutor's office, and they crossed paths while she was in the DA's office.
Oh.
So he quickly became, like, her backbone, number one supporter, and, like, her bodyguard. He encouraged her to share her story and advocate for victims' rights. And one of her first speaking engagements was in a high school where she wanted to share her story to prevent teenagers from hitchhiking. However, during this speech, one of the students yelled out, "You got what you deserved."
What the fuck?
And so she refused to do school appearances for the rest of her career.
Kids really be ruining everything.
They really do.
One time, this is very unrelated and not at all as serious as that, but quick detour. In high school, I did, like, a lot of musical theater, and we did Peter Pan, and I was the understudy for Peter. And the understudies got to do, like, two performances for, like, students from, like, elementary and middle schools that were nearby. And so I got to do this one performance, but the whole audience was, like, kids. And there's a part in the show where, like, Tinkerbell is dying or whatever, and Peter comes out and is, like, he's the only one on stage, and you have to be, like, tell Tinkerbell that you believe in fairies and then we can, like, restore her light or whatever the fuck. And we have to be, like, and I'm, like, do you believe in fairies? And, like, this army of middle schoolers just all yell back, no. And I was, like, I literally almost was, like, well, she's dead.
Oh, my God.
It was so awkward. I was just, like, do you believe in fairies? And then, like, all these, like, 12-year-old boys were like, no.
And you're like, wrong, like, answer.
I just, like, ignored them because there was, like, a group of, like, little kids, like, second graders who were like, yes, and were, like, very into it. So I just, like, focused on them. But so much of my heart and soul wanted to be like, well, she's dead then, I guess. Bye, everybody.
I would have loved that. I would have loved to have a video of that. Let it be known.
Yeah, so anyway, kids suck.
Mary and Tom worked together building a happy and healthy life. They got married in 1999 in a small intimate wedding. And since she was unable to wear a wedding ring, he bought her a diamond necklace. They had two sons, Alan and Luke. Mary attended the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and continued to work as a victims advocate. She also became an artist.
Right on.
She woke up one day and said that artwork inspired her and gave her self-esteem. And she's actually become a, like, popular artist, and some of her pieces have been valued at, like, $2,000.
I love that for her.
So, yeah. But we'll talk about Lawrence a little bit more after his release and whatnot. So after he was released, he was forcibly driven out of multiple homes and towns by hordes of people protesting his presence in their community.
Good.
For the year of his parole, he was set up in a trailer on the grounds of San Quentin. He was constantly under surveillance by guards, had a strict curfew, and was sent to mandatory AA counseling.
Okay.
He was basically, like, in prison still, but outside of prison.
Yeah. Like, house arrest kind of thing?
Pretty much, yeah. So he was, he became a recluse pretty much until, like, he was released from parole, and then he moved to Florida. However, you know, prison doesn't rehabilitate people. They just are still assholes when they come out. And so he was convicted twice again in 1990, once for stealing a $10 disposable camera, and so he spent 60 days in jail, and then for stealing a $3 hat. Where he served 2 years.
I feel like that's one of those situations of, like, the judge just being like, I know who you are.
Right. He's like, fuck you.
Yeah.
He was even put in a psych ward a few times for attempted suicide. Which, you know, he didn't try hard enough.
The shade.
I mean, but it gets so much better.
That sounded sarcastic.
A man in Florida called the police after witnessing a man viciously bludgeoning a bloody, limp woman through a window of his house. He said that he could hear her bones crushing like chicken bones breaking.
Oh my God.
The police came quickly and discovered Lawrence Singleton in the home, covered in blood, and a dead sex worker on his couch. The woman was Roxanne Hayes, 31 years old, mother of three, who was working as a sex worker to support her family.
Sad.
He had picked her up for a date and agreed on $20. Once they got back to his house, he proceeded to stab her multiple times with a boning knife. So Mary heard about this murder and his arrest. Mm-hmm. And so she traveled to Florida to speak at his trial.
Mm-hmm.
So she testified, and this is a quote from her. "I was raped, I had my arms cut off, he used a hatchet, and he left me to die." While pointing at him, like, directly with her prosthetic hook. He also attempted to sue Mary, because he said he felt like the victim.
What the fuck?
Saying she forcibly kidnapped him for purpose of robbery. He said that he had searched his conscience and determined that he was not capable of such an evil deed. When he thought about the vile accusations that had been made against him, it made him physically sick.
I'm gonna need this man to not.
Yeah. He's...
So what? Where is he now?
Dead. He died of cancer in 2001. He was convicted for, like, the death sentence, but he didn't get to be executed because he died of cancer.
Yeah, because you're, like... I feel like the thing with, like, when people put, like... Not to, like, get political, but when people are, like, the death sentence, they, like, think that it's, like, you leave your trial and immediately go get killed. It's, like, you're on death row for, like...
20 years, if not longer.
Yeah, for real. Like, most of the people who get put on the death like, death row never actually get the death sentence.
Yeah, they end up dying by natural causes.
Yeah. Well.
Oh, but no, there's a happy ending.
There is?
Yes. Mary
well, she's
helped.
Alive, that's good.
Well, Mary helped enact legislation that prevented the early release of offenders who have committed a crime where torture is used. It's mm-hmm. called the Singleton's Bill and carries a 25 to life sentence.
Oh, good.
And as of 2017, Mary no longer recognizes Singleton by name and only refers to him as my attacker. She's not giving him any more power over him, over her.
She's like a badass, though.
Yeah, and then this is the story that I've been wanting to do for a while.
I looked her up, and there's, like, all these pictures of her, like, playing pool and stuff with her.
She's such a badass.
And, like, walking dogs and things, and I'm like, you're so...
If you ever, like, want to see more about her, she does a whole episode of I Survived, and it's really cool.
I'm gonna go watch that.
But... She's a badass. She really fucking did that. Like, the fact that she's thought to cover her arms in mud to stop like, the I'm bleeding. Like,
that's crazy.
It's just so amazing.
Yeah.
That's why I was, because you were like, I don't think a true crime story can have a happy ending. And I was determined to prove you wrong.
Oh, this was your happy ending? Well, mm-hmm. I feel like, I guess the reason it's like, I don't think it can have a happy ending is because the happier ending would be if, like, none of it had happened at all, you know?
I mean, yeah, no, 100%.
But I guess, like, a happy ending doesn't necessarily mean that, like, everything about the story is happy. Like, you can have a happy ending even, like, with something that was a tragedy. So, like, the fact that she survived and she's, like, married and an artist and she, like...
As a victim's right advocate and, like... helped enact legislator
like
to make that happen
people.
Again.
Yeah. It's, like, about making the most of, like, such a shitty situation.
Exactly. And so that's the badass story of Mary Vincent.
I'm a very Mary Vincent fan club.
Honestly, yeah, that's the new... This podcast is just a Mary Vincent fan club. I will start a stan Twitter for her.
She needs some stans.
Honestly, yeah. I think
she already does, because I literally found, like, fan art of her. Like, somebody made, like, a Rosie the Riveter, but it's her.
Oh my god, I love that.
It's dope. Anyway, so, I appreciate yours, because the Zodiac Killer story does not have a happy ending. No one was ever charged.
Yeah, it does not, but mine does.
Go team. Which is funny, because I'm normally the one who's like, I hate unsolved crime, it's so unsatisfying.
Yeah, and you're like, let's do something that's unsolved.
Yeah. This was just like, we're switching. Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed our first episode back from our little
very
hiatus.
Long first episode back.
Yeah, we just, like, made up for all the lost time.
We really did. We said, oh, we've been gone for a month. Okay, here's a 2-hour episode.
Have fun, kids.
Enjoy.
But we will see you soon when we are hopefully in the same room together.
That's gonna be so wild. Oh my god.
I know, I can't even handle it.
Me either.
Is there anything you would like to say before we depart?
Nah.
Okay, so that's that on that.
That's that.
Oh, I will say, I just, while I was doing this, I kind of went on I know I use Spotify exclusively just like as a person, and I think, Chris, you're also a Spotify user.
Yeah.
You can't really like rate podcasts on Spotify, but I did see that a lot of our listeners use Apple like music and like Apple podcasts. So if you do use the Apple podcast app, it would mean a lot to us if you gave us 5 stars and wrote a review and all of that, because right now we have a couple 5-star reviews, which is super nice, but I also would love to read a review. I don't know. I feel like it would just make my heart sore.
Honestly, yeah. I would love to read that. I only use Apple Podcasts. Like, I use Spotify for music, but I don't use it for podcasts.
Okay, so
I'll go leave us a review.
Chris, go leave us a review, and then I'll be satisfied.
1 star.
No.
I wanted to like this podcast, but...
But they just kept talking.
They were talking about... I was going to try and think of something that we had talked about before, but my brain just drew a complete blank, and I suddenly could not remember a single thing we have ever said to each other.
That's actually the perfect description of this podcast.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay, so with that being said, we will see you next week.
Yeah. Bye.
Stay spooky, y'all.